In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. Praised be Jesus Christ, and to Mary Immaculate Queen, and good Saint Joseph the Just, now and forever. A few days ago, I finished a tape which I've titled, Which Bishop Shall I Follow? And toward the end of that tape, I said I would try to make another tape and title it, Another Evident Contradiction. And that is a tape you are now listening to. Let me ask, if there is no place on earth where you can find any hens, and there is no place you can find any eggs, if you have neither chickens or eggs, what do you have? Little hope of ever obtaining one, right? Well, the laws of the church tell us that only cardinals can elect a valid pope, and only a pope can create new cardinals. With the things that have gone on since Vatican Council II, all the cardinals signing the radical decrees of Vatican II, resigning their office, there are no cardinals eligible to elect the pope, and there's no pope eligible to elect the cardinals. Seems like a very evident contradiction, doesn't it, for me to tell you then that if you'll stay listening to this tape, I'm going to give you what I believe is, honestly, a true solution to this serious problem. In other words, I'm going to explain to you what, in my mind, seems to be a valid, true solution to electing another pope, although at this time we have no cardinals with any authority or jurisdiction in the church, and I will explain if this can be done without breaking any laws of the church. I don't even think we have to invoke Epikaya. But before we get into all of that, there are many other evident contradictions with regards to many things. One of them, with regards to the all Roman Catholic line, some have wondered why I no longer function as a priest. Well, these are some of the reasons then. I refer now to a book titled Outlines for Dogmatic Theology by Sylvester Joseph Hunter of the Society of Jesus, Volume 3. Benziger Brothers, printed to the Holy Apostolic See, 1846, as a Nikil Obstate of Ioannis Clayton S.J., and an imprimatur by Herbert Cardinal Wagon, July 13, 1846. If you will note, this book was printed before Pope Leo XIII came out with Apostolici Curiae with regard to the invalid Anglican orders. And under this section of the book, then, a matter and form for the sacraments, it reads, it need hardly be said that in the West, the omission of either the imposition of hands or other tradition would render the ordination doubtful, if not void. And therefore, no one who had gone through a named ceremony could lawfully exercise any order he possessed until he had been again ordained, at least conditionally. And so Father Hunter is telling us here that with regards to the sacrament of holy orders, if there is a doubt about the validity of holy orders, one must always assume that those orders are invalid until such time that he can prove they are valid. And this Father Hunter then goes into explaining about Anglican orders with regards to Bishop Parker, if he was a bishop, and Bishop Barlow. And he's very much informative information here, but he concludes toward the end, Rome has constantly for centuries treated it as certain that the Anglican clergy have no orders. And I remind you again that it was only in after years that Pope Leo XIII came out and solemnly defined that statement, what this Reverend Sylvester Joseph Hunter explained to us, that if there's a doubt about the validity of ordination, one must assume those orders are invalid unless they can prove they are valid. And that was the case, that people should have considered the Anglican orders. And the same basic teaching of the church is found elsewhere in books. For example, in a practical commentary in the Code of Canon Law by Stanislaus Wolberg, under Canon 1014, he tells us that if doubt arises as to the validity of a marriage contracted, the validity must be upheld until the contrary is proved, which is the opposite in the case of holy orders, in which they must be held as invalid unless the contrary is proved that they are valid, showing us that because marriage is the foundation of society, and because if everyone that had a doubt about their marriage just left their spouse and went about and got married again or something, there'd be a complete chaos. Sacrament of Holy Orders is just the opposite, because you cannot be playing games whether someone is validly ordained or not, because that means if he's not validly ordained, no matter how exact he follows the matter form and even has the intention, if he does not have the character of the priest on his soul, then obviously he cannot absolve from sins or consecrate the Holy Eucharist and to the functions of a priest. Before I was able to find this teaching in various books, I had talked to individual people, one of them being Bishop Sylvester W. Trinan, the conciliar bishop of Boise, Idaho, and he told me that's a teaching of the church. Talked to another man who's done a lot of research, he's mixed up in other ways, but Mr. Christopher Shannon, he told me that's a teaching of the church. Talked to Mr. Benjamin W. Drinan, and he's quite a learned man, and there are other things he might explain about that, but he told me that that is the teaching of the church. And I talked to Mr. Paul Strammer in Eureka, Montana, who did a very lot of research because he was involved with that. Schismatic Bishop Joseph Maria Weber, and on his studies he also found this teaching of the church that if there's a doubt about the validity of holy orders, one must assume they're invalid unless he can prove for certain that they are valid. In other words, he must live as a layman unless he has certainty his orders are valid. And with that being said, then let us find out about the orders that came through Bishop Francis Conrad Schuckardt. And we will begin by listening to the voice of Bishop Francis Schuckardt from his question and answer session of the San Diego Seminar 1983.
I would like to remember that Bishop Brown was born a Catholic, raised a Catholic, and was only born by a computer. The gods make those drastic changes in the faith, but even conscience cannot go along with those changes. Announcing Vatican II was then consecrated in the old Roman Catholic Church because he knew for certain that that church had valid orders, while the Church of Vatican II does not.
And that is the point we're trying to explain here as another evident contradiction. How does Bishop Brown know for certain that those orders are valid in the old Roman Catholic Church? Just remember this point and keep it in mind as you hear the other things we're going to try and explain hereafter. And now I'm going to dive in to hear part of a phone conversation I have with a Mr. Paul Strammer, Post Office Box 116, Eureka, Montana. That's capital EUREKA, Montana 59917. Phone number is 406-889-3583. I think the tape will explain itself. If not, I'll comment on it afterwards.
I've been down the same road. I don't know if Father Lucian, how much of my background he gave you.
Oh, just hardly any. He just said that you were a layman who did some research on a bishop up in your country, and that's why you had this information.
Okay.
The phone conversation to ask you to take note that the man's name is Joseph Maria Rober, because we're going to then let you know what the Reverend Thomas C. Fooey says about Joseph Maria Rober and how he's hooked up with Bishop Moosey, and also to take note that he goes to the old Roman Catholic line through Arnold Harris Matthew, because that's the same one that Bishop Francis Schuckardt traces through.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I meant to tell you when I first started my conversation, yeah. I'm trying to tape this conversation because I want to get this information down and won't keep it all in my head, if that's all right with you.
Well, that's fine with me.
All right, thank you.
I have nothing to hide, and everything that I tell you is from memory. Now, my memory may not be perfect, but I should be able to back up everything that I tell you from these people's own records and so forth. And if I say something that's opinion, I'll try and
all right. I just didn't want to try and pony fast with the language, because I do want this down on tape if it'll work, you know?
Well, that's fine. I'll give you a chance to check your tape and see that it's recording if you'd like.
Well, that's all right.
All right. Anyway, I became, in 7 years of defending this Joseph Ria's orders, I would take my family to his masses every day. I gradually became more and more involved with him until he finally had the idea, since I had a chapel in Big Fork, Montana, he had the idea one time that he figured I should be a deacon. So I imagine that appealed to my pride fairly well, and he wasn't there to, no one was there to tell me not to. I wasn't studying canon law and dogmatic and moral theology and any of the church teachings like I should have. Anyway, I got conned into it. And because I was so involved with him, I began to defend his orders because of naturally, like a manager situation, you'd either want those orders to be valid or not. You know, you have to have your feet on the ground. Well, in 6 or 7 years of trying to defend his orders, I ran up against a solid brick wall. Everywhere I turned, when they finally got to the questioning of how was it done and what lines did he go into and so on, it always came up doubtful. And finally, another priest came and stayed with us for 6 months and 3 days.
And lived at your place, you mean?
Yeah. And we went into it in very strenuous detail. And he showed me the excommunication by Pope St. Pius X of Arnold Harris Matthew. He was excommunicated avi tandi. And at the time, I didn't ask him, but later on in speaking with Father Dolan, who is with the Society of Pius X, or was, I guess he's split from them now, but who was ordained by Lefebvre, he said that when the excommunication was given, the people prevailed upon St. Pius X to decide whether those orders were valid or not. And he said, I refuse. My statement is good enough for you. In other words, I'm not going to open that can of worms because it'd be a long and tedious process to try and straighten it out, and there's no point in it because there's plenty of places that all these people can go to the true church. They don't have to fool around with the man that I've just declared avi tandem. In any case, it didn't stop Arnold Harris Matthew. He kept right on, and I'm not sure what the lines of succession are, but I am sure that Daniel Q. Brown goes into the Matthew line. Maybe you could verify that. Is that?
Yes, that's what I have from the information I have, and that's what Bishop Francis or Francis Schuckardt says he comes from.
Yes.
Eventually goes back to Matthew.
Right, it does. Now, there have been debates on that question since all of this stuff has taken place, you see, since Matthew lived. But it's never been decided by the church. That's the whole point. The whole crux of the situation is that who are we to decide a matter for ourselves that the church refused to decide? You see? My idea was, if I can't prove that they're valid, then what business have I got going to this man's mass? Now, from what I understand of the teachings of the church, we're not allowed to go to sacraments that are doubtful as to their validity, and in normal times, even their licentiousness. They have to be valid and licit, and we have to be able to be morally certain that they're valid and licit. Now, it is licit, according to the law, Canon 2261, that in abnormal times, in emergencies, at the point of death, and so on and so forth, you can approach heretics. But the 2261 even states that you have to be certain that the orders are valid. So we quit going to Joseph Maria Robert. And
right.
I backed up just like you're doing, and I admire you for that, because I know it takes some courage and it takes a lot of humility and a lot of patience with yourself and real dedication to the truth to stop acting, you know, like you've been used to for all those years, and change your life and take it all back and be willing. That shows a tremendous sincerity as far as I'm concerned. And I think the good Lord loves you for it. I have several documents here that I'd like to get your address so that I can send you these things. You can look at some of this stuff for yourself. And then I'd also like you to get a hold of, if you need that final part on it, you should get a hold of Father Dolan and ask him to send you the proof.
Could you give me his address? And also, if you could speak kind of loud, and maybe this will pick up better, but if you could give me their address, and I'll give you ours, yes. You have it, that Father Dolan?
Go ahead and give me yours. I'm looking for his.
All right. Just, I guess, Patrick Henry, at Route 2, Box 957, Safford, that's SAFFORD, in Arizona. Zip code down here is 85546.
Now, I'm skipping over a little bit of our conversation. It doesn't pertain to our subject here now. We'll pick up Mr. Stremmer again.
You'll hear that was written by those priests of the Society of Pius X. It's called A Disgraceful History of an Heretical Succession. And it was published in March of 76. And it's very revealing as to the all the antics that went on back then.
With regards to Matthew and all that, I guess.
Yeah, first part of the century. It has the whole works there, the succession. I'll just drop a few names on you and you try them out on you and see if you recognize any of them. George Gerard Shelley, Richard Arthur Marchena, Carmel Henry Carfora. These guys are all in the line of succession. Some of the guys that... Now, I don't know who it was that ordained or consecrated Daniel Q. Brown. Do you?
Rogers. As far as I know, there's two opinions, but it seems that Rogers was the one. I have a little bit of information from people, but that's what I have down anyway. See, I don't know too much about it. I haven't really checked up until recently, unfortunately.
Well,
but
I have seen that line of succession from Dan Q. Brown on back, but darn if I can find it. I was looking for it when Father Lucian was here and didn't have any luck, and I still haven't found it. I know it's around here somewhere, because it's one of the lines that Joseph Maria Robert used to try and defend his own orders. And when he was so heavily spoken against by the people in the Society of Pius X in Montana, then he dropped that line and went to a line that goes back to the Eastern Orthodox. And of course, it didn't have much of an effect because the way his was done by the man in England that conditionally reconsecrated him still leaves it doubtful, even if that particular individual's orders were valid. There was no way to prove any of it. So, I don't know how much training you guys got as far as moral and dogmatic theology or canon law or any of it, but just from my own study, and this is completely unguided with the exception of a few priests that I'd ask questions of every now and again, I came to the conclusion that we had to have at least the least of the three certainties, moral certitude, on the sacraments. Otherwise, go someplace else or don't go at all. Now, does that make any sense to you?
That's why I'm here, not up there.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that that's the only route we've got.
Well, one thing that, do you have enough research to know that, from what I understand, it would seem that Bishop Matthews was valid. But, you know, then the only thing that seems wrong now is that St. Pius X not only excommunicated him, but he also questioned his validity. Is that right?
Well, Matthew himself could have been valid. We don't know. He was in and out of the church so many times that it's hard to, you know. I've got a history of him, too, written by the Society of Pius X. In fact, when you write to those guys, you should ask them for everything they've got on the old Catholics, particularly the Matthew line, because they have researched all of that thoroughly, and they have the succession and the whole smear. It's all in print. It's appeared as a series of articles in their publications, the Roman Catholic and the Angelus. That'd be very valuable to you. Even if Matthew was valid, all the shenanigans and the simony and so forth that went on when he started consecrating and ordaining and so on leaves so much doubt that it doesn't matter really whether he was valid or not. Even if he was valid, there's still serious objective doubts as to whether those orders were passed along intact. See what I'm saying?
In other words, he might have been all right, but he didn't do what was right to pass it to his next successors.
Well, one of those guys didn't do it.
Right.
Correctly. I know there were some of those guys that they'd ordain anybody just at the drop of a hat. Well, I'll tell you a little story. Just to give you an example of how those guys get after a while. This local guy here, he had ordained another guy as a deacon before I came into the picture. And then the guy wasn't satisfied. He prevailed upon this Joseph Maria to make him a priest. And Joseph Maria wouldn't do that because he's gotten so much heat before because he'd ordained many, many married men before. So he shied away. He was gun-shy. But he said, I know a guy that'll ordain pretty near anybody. A guy by the name of, I've forgotten his name. Anyway, he lives in Montreal, Canada. So he wrote a letter up there and introduced him. Oh, it was Andre Barbeau was the guy's name, my wife reminded me. And he introduced him by letter. And then a few weeks later, the other local guy went up there, the guy that was a deacon, he went up there and Andre Barbeau made him a priest and offered to make him a bishop right there on the spot.
That quick with no...
Pardon me?
That quick with no more knowledge of him than that?
Mm-hmm. Right there on the spot. In any case, later on, I couldn't get any verification out of any of them, you know. I found out later on when this Father Watson from the Knights of Malta was up here that the original orders that the man had up in San Jovite where this Clement the 15th had claimed that an angel had made him a bishop. Now, he was also a Roman Catholic priest, and so is this John of Trinity. They were both validly and licitly ordained in the church, and then they left the church and obtained their consecrations as bishops outside. This Clement the 15th claimed that an angel had come and made him a bishop, and then he proceeded to consecrate John of Trinity. Well, then this John of Trinity made Joseph Maria down here in Kalispell a priest and a bishop, supposedly. And he actually, he knew no more about the validity of orders. He actually believed that he was a priest and a bishop by an angel. Third time removed. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So they were traveling in England, this John of Trinity and Joseph Maria Roberts. And they came on to this old Catholic by the name of Brerley. He had a little church in London. And he heard their story and heard what they were trying to do, and they were supposed to be sticking to tradition. This was when Paul VI was supposedly a pope. And they wouldn't say the new mass and so on and so forth. And he said, well, it's fine what you're trying to do, but there's one thing wrong, and that is that Rome is never going to buy your orders. So you better let me conditionally reconsecrate you, and then everything will be all right. And I can give you papers and so on and so forth. So they let this Brerley do it. He was an old Catholic, and he went into the Matthew line, and he had been conditionally redone several times. And it's just a big mess is what it is. In any case, what he did was, rather than to take out the Pontificale Romanum and go through the whole ritual, he just did it what the way the French refer to it as charimontie. He just, the laying on of hands only. And that was supposed to be sufficient to make them, if they weren't, priests and bishops. Conditionally, see? Well, I've got a local, this Joseph Maria Robert, I've got his own letter signed by his own hand, the original letters, admitting all of this, and admitting that of his doubts of his own ordination and so forth, and asking for a conditional reordination by Father Wathen, bishop, Father Wathen, the Knights of Malta. We had a bishop that was in communion with the church, an Eastern Rite bishop, who was valid. And of course, when they found all this out, and of course, they refused to do it conditionally because of his situation and because of his lack of theological training and his obvious lack of understanding of theology and so forth. And so we had no choice, Pat, but just to pull the plug, just like you're doing, and then try and get our information as straight as possible and present it as straight as we know how, as truthfully as we know how, to those of our relatives that are still going to him, just like you're trying to do with your brother. And I'll give you just by way of a little bit of, so you know what to expect. It's very difficult. You've already been through this probably to some extent. It's very difficult to get anybody to see it. Mostly because, you know, people, they want to be Catholics, and that's admirable. And they see something dreadfully wrong with the Novus Ordo Church, so anybody, almost anybody that comes down the pike that says the true mass, boy, they're ready to jump on the bandwagon and stay there. And they're willing to overlook all kinds of errors and garbage, scandal, and what have you, to grasp that and hang on to it. Of course, there's a lot of psychology that goes in on that, a lot of spiritual things, a lot of temptations and so forth. That's why they don't see the light. But I guess all we can do is just keep trying, try and get our information straight.
And now I would also like to let you know some more information on this Bishop Brerley, who in effect just put his hands on this Joseph Maria Robur and said, Bert, bingo, I make you a bishop. This Joseph Maria Robur's real name is Bert Robur. I would now like to turn to a book titled Bishops at Large by Peter F. Hansen. It has a copyright 1964, and this book is very, very well documented. For example, back in the bibliography, Mr. Hansen gives at least 36 different references for his chapter 6 on Arnold Harris Matthews, and he gives a number of references for all these different bishops and the churches that come from their succession. Anyway, this book then explains some things about this Mr. or maybe Bishop Charles Burley, opening up the book on page 379, where he's in the chapter Churches of the Matthew Succession. I read, the old Holy Catholic Church evolved out of the old Catholic Evangelical Church of God in 1955. There have been recorded about the early life of its founder, Charles Burley, but it appeared that from boyhood, like the cleric just mentioned, he was convinced that God was calling him to serve the Lord and to save sinners. Burley is said to have earned his living in manual occupations and later on to have engaged in evangelistic work with the church army. Stories that he tried to persuade several bishops of different denominations to ordain him have been strenuously denied. All that in the early 30s he had found secular employment in Sheffield. No matter, eventually he became the lay minister of a small independent Protestant mission chapel at Henley, a southern suburb of the city. Having no narrow sectarian scruples, he appealed to Archbishop Cooper, who on Sunday, January 31st, 1954, laid hands on him in a rented room at Sheffield. The new prelate was placed in charge of the northern province of the old Catholic Evangelical Church of God, which had very few adherents in Yorkshire at that date. So far as is known, the name of the bishop who raised Burley to minor and major orders up to the priesthood has never been published. Archbishop Cooper returned to London after a weekend in Sheffield, and it was not long before he broke off relations with this northern metropolitan. The reason given was that both Bishop Burley and Dr. Pitt Keithley, then acting as archdeacon, wished for what was described as, quote, a more democratic way of church government to which the archbishop was opposed, unquote. Footnote tells us, on June 18, 1960, Keithley was raised to the episcopate by Bishop Julian Ernie, assisted by Bishop W.H. Turner. He held the offices of administrator for Great Britain of the Reformed Catholic Church, Utrecht Confession. The bishop, representative of the Universal Life Foundation and International Academy of Burnaby, B.C., Canada. He now held, among other offices, those of British representative of the United Old Catholic Patriarchate of the World, and belongs to the Sacred Synod. There's a bunch of things here in French, I believe. Bishop Pitt Keithley is also said to be a fellow of the Evangelical Preachers Association. Back to the text. Finding himself definitely a bishop at large in Yorkshire, subject to no higher authority but God, and apparently not content with the old Catholic succession believed to have been derived from Cooper, Burley welcomed an invitation from Mar Philippus to be reconsecrated at his hands. It was a tempting offer because it guaranteed the 18 or more lines of succession understood to have been imparted to Mar Philippus by Mar Uranus, Archbishop of Corwin, by way of Mar Tagoras, Patriarch of Glastonbury. So he went to London and called on Mar Philippus, who had recently assumed the primacy of a tiny sect known as, quote, the New Catholic and Free Church, unquote, of which he was the founder. On Sunday, November 14, 1954, the two bishops exchanged consecrations in a room of a house at 5 Bramshill Road, N10, which served Mar Philippus as a pro-cathedral. It seems to have been on this occasion that Burley met for the first time Mr. Leslie Percy and his wife Maureen, both theophilists and members of the Liberal Catholic Church, a meeting that was to have unforeseen influence on his future career. By way of trial and error, the former church army evangelist and independent Protestant minister was gradually finding its way towards a species of Catholicism which, so it must be admitted, has always remained somewhat fluid in doctrine and discipline so far as outsiders can make out. Bishop Burley soon acquired new values in South Yorkshire, and with good reason, for he could now proclaim that he was the 137th in line from St. Peter the Apostle as first bishop of Antioch on February 21st, 1955, the Sheathfield Telegraph published a full-length photograph of him in cope and mitre taken outside of St. Peter's Mission Chapel at Healy. Towards the end of that same year, the twice consecrated prelate was obliged to resign his charge and to close the ministerial training college he had opened in this suburb of Sheathfield. Mrs. Percy then allowed him to become a resident chaplain at Cusworth Hall near Doncaster, and it gives a footnote here. She had been blessed as abbess of Bethany by Archbishop Nick Colson of Carwen, and it was stated that in July 1954 she was raised to the diaconate and priesthood by Archbishop Matthias Victor Schoenbruch of the Free Catholic Church in Germany. It says, see page 483. It appears that immediately after this she was consecrated a bishopess. Anyway, the book goes on to explain much more, but here on page 428, her facing it's a picture. At the top is the most illustrious Lord Cardinal Henry Cafora, Supreme Primate of the North American Old Roman Catholic Church. And under him is another picture of about nine people. Left to right, the Most Reverend Sister Mary Frances, OSHTD, Marquise de Salmi, Lady Abbess of Bethany with mitre and crozier, the Reverend Sister Marie Phillips in white veil with cape, the right Reverend Abbess Dorcas in beretta, corda, and cope, the Most Reverend Ignatius Carolus Burley, D.D., D.C.L., Archbishop and Primate of the Old Holy Catholic Church, the Right Reverend George W. Boyer, Bishop of Boston, the Right Reverend William H. Turner, Bishop of London in the South of England, and then there's that Crestworth Hall, Doncaster. But now let's turn back to page 383, where it continues on explaining how this Bishop Burley's succession developed. He started this church, the New Age institution, with its roots in apostolic tradition. And it says here, thanks to Arnold Harris Matthew, consecrated as regional old Catholic bishop for Britain in 1908, with the Willowburnian line of apostolic succession is passed on to the old Holy Catholic Church, which also claimed to have acquired the Antiochian, Assyrian, and other lines. And to show how messed up things get, I would like to read a photocopy of a letter that this Mr. Paul Stemmer sent me with regards to this. Joseph Maria Wilbur has the big picture and everything of the heading on it from West Glacier, Montana. Bert Wilbur's letterhead, stated February 16, 1981. Dear Father Rappin, I was so disappointed that I could not see you when you were here in Montana, for I wanted to present my point of view. To hear things from other sources or not to hear the other side gives not a true picture. I have tried everything possible to get things straightened out without success. I have been approached by various people to join all sorts of alliances, and each time I have declined, for I am a Roman Catholic and simply cannot subscribe and affiliate with something which is not Catholic. Anyway, as you know, I made the big mistake in my past life to join the group in Canada, and I have recognized those mistakes a long time ago. I undertook those mistakes innocently and ignorantly, hoping to fight against heresy in the church, but it was the wrong way. Instead of doing good, there came only harm out of it. They made me a bishop, and he put in parentheses a question mark, saying it is from, quote, heaven, unquote, but it wasn't. I was mixed up, as so many are mixed up today and do not know where to turn or what to do. I am not interested in ordaining anyone. And here then, Mr. Stromer, I suppose, underlined that last sentence, and he wrote in the margin, Father Joseph ordained James de Kazel after this, at the request of Father George Musey in Houston, Texas. Father de Kazel was married and civilly divorced, but claimed his marriage had been invalid and is supposed to have a letter of release of his marital duties from his wife in quotes, which he refuses to let anyone but Father Musi see. And I guess I should explain here that when the first time I read these things to you, this Father DeCaso did not leave much of an impression upon me. But since I was told, and even when I talked to Father Thomas C. Fui, the Vicar General Bishop George Musi, he talked about this James DeCaso and how crazy off the rocker he went. And it didn't make too much sense. His name did not register then, even because I have a hard time remembering names for one reason. But now I believe his name will quite well register, because I understand his part in the great mixed-up puzzle that's become quite clear by now. There's another man at a party. His name is Father Pierre Pothier. At least you spell it capital P-O-T-H-I-E-R. He's a French priest that came down from Canada. But anyway, Pierre, he just wishes to be called as a secular man, not a priest. Tried to contact Mount St. Michael's at least 10 times to talk to the Reverend Robert Chicoine, alias Father Dennis Philomena Marie. And if you have heard the tape that I sent to Bishop George Musi on March 13th, 1986, explaining about the religious vows and religious profession, you'll know why on this tape I am not speaking of the CMRI members as religious. And if you heard the tape, which Bishop should I follow, which I've made just a short time ago, then you will know why the orders of the Reverend Robert Chicoine are at least gravely questionable yet. But anyway, it is Pierre tried to call Reverend Chicoine, like I said, at least 10 times, and got no answer. So a friend of a friend of a friend, as he worded it, gave him my phone number, and he called me up and talked to me for a while. And I've had quite a discussion with this Pierre, but anyway, he told me some things about this Father James DeCaso. Pierre told him not to get ordained by anybody, but this James DeCaso went and got ordained by this Father or Bishop Joseph Maria Weber. And then he got faculties from Bishop George Musi. And since that time, I guess they've split and gone their ways, and now he's gone up, I think, in Canada or someplace to schismatic, right? Got himself supposedly consecrated a bishop, and he's really maybe conceited, but he called himself the first primate of such and such. He's got quite a bunch of titles behind his name. But that's the way it is. Now, why did Bishop George Musi give this man faculties? We've heard how Joseph Maria Weber got lined up. And where did Joseph Maria Weber get any consecration from any Catholic line? But anyway, let us go on then with this letter of Joseph Maria Weber to Father Laughlin of February 16th, 1981. For all those wrong things, I am sorry. Because of my doubts that I am truly a priest, it would be nice if you would consider the possibility of me being reordained conditionally, not as bishop but only as priest, by your Catholic bishop. And Mr. Stremmer underlined this Catholic bishop and put in the margin this Berkeley of Canada. This is the one, if you remember from his tape, ordains or consecrates anyone at the drop of a hat, or you might sit at the drop of the mitre in the flash of the crozier. Let us go on. I know very well that before you can present my case to your bishop, I will have to submit under oath in various points to convince you that I truly neglect the past and am repenting and having offended God with my too many stupidities. Those two should be one proof for you, which does not come into question here, that I already went to confession to a Jesuit priest at the Immaculate Conception Church in New Orleans and accused myself of heresy, schism, apostasy, and excommunication. It was not easy for me to do, but I did it, and I am only interested that I could say Holy Mass truly, honestly, and with a good conscience. It would be the greatest thing in my life if this could be brought about. So I'm ready and willing to submit myself to you and to the bishop, who might be willing to reordain me conditionally. A final thought, I think it might interest you that during the past years I was approached by a few people, secular and religious, to ordain and even, quote, consecrate, unquote, them. Each time I declined, here it is against me to do this. All those things could have been talked about if I had met you a few weeks ago. Once more, I would be grateful for a reordination as priest if possible, but not as a bishop. I gladly forfeit that. This is no sacrifice. I do not care for that. Through the Immaculate Mary, Father Joseph Maria Wilbur. As a P.S., this might interest you also that I would like to pronounce the anti-modernist oath, which I have never done and always regretted. Yet that those who reordained me did not demand it and not do it. And that's the end of this letter. But that all being said, now let us hear what the Vicar General Bishop George Musey, the Reverend Thomas C. Foo, has to say about this. Joseph Maria Wilbur.
On November 26, 1985.
Refer me to a Mr. Paul Stremmer in Montana, Eureka, Montana.
What name?
Paul Stremmer.
Stremmer,
I guess. S-T-R-A-M-M-E-R, I think.
I never heard of him. Did you see him?
No, I only talked to him over the phone also.
Yeah.
He told me some things because he had done a lot of research about